The Democratic Party has historically been credited with supporting a woman's right to choose, Social Security and Medicare, and labor rights and civil liberties. What does their record on those issues tell about where the party stands today? On today's Your Call, we're talking about the current state of the Democratic Party. Who's the base of the Democratic Party? Who's leading it? Who's funding it? How has the party changed over the years? And what does it really stand for? Are you a Democrat? Do you consider yourself a former Democrat? How would you describe the Democratic Party? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. Demonstrations have taken place across Nigeria against the rising price of fuel following the removal of government subsidies. A general strike is underway, with public transport at a halt and shops and offices closed. At least one person was killed and others injured in the northern city of Kano during clashes with the police, while in Lagos, a demonstrator died after police opened fire to disperse a crowd. These protesters in Lagos voiced their grievances about the government of Goodluck Jonathan.
This is madness. Jonathan is a dummy, does not know what he's doing. I'm telling you, he's a dummy. We need someone that is intelligent.
Well, the government, they just have to start this all over again. I know fuel subsidy removal is imminent, but you can't spring it on us. You have to cushion the effect.
Nigeria's information minister is calling on the unions to end the strike. He said the authorities are doing their best to reduce the hardship caused by removing the subsidy. Nigerian Muslims and Christians are on the move after recent attacks on each other's places of worship. Thousands of northern Muslims are reported to be returning home from the south, while Christians in the north head in the opposite direction. A crowd in southern Nigeria burnt a mosque today and injured more than 40 Muslims in Benin City. There's heightened religious tension across Nigeria following attacks on churches on Christmas Day that left at least 35 people dead. The head of the Swiss National Bank, who's at the centre of a row over alleged insider trading, has announced that he's resigned. Philipp Hildebrandt has been accused of benefiting from a currency deal made by his wife last year. Cashier Hildebrandt bought $500,000 shortly before the SNB lowered the value of the Swiss franc, a deal that yielded more than $60,000. Mr. Hildebrandt denied the allegations, but admitted he couldn't prove his innocence.
I have come to the conclusion that it is not possible to provide conclusive and final evidence that my wife did indeed initiate the foreign exchange transaction on the 15th of August without my knowledge. The fact is, my word is my bond. I had no knowledge of my wife's transaction on that day.
The British Prime Minister, David Cameron, says uncertainty over Scotland's future within the United Kingdom is damaging its economy. The British government is expected to publish proposals within days for a referendum on independence in Scotland, which might require a simple choice of yes or no. But Mr. Cameron has denied trying to dictate terms to the Scottish government.
All the time, business is asking, is Scotland going to be part of the United Kingdom? Are they going to stay together? Should I invest? And we're beginning to see companies asking those questions. So I think it's at least rational to put to the Scottish people, would it be better to have a more fair and decisive question put earlier? But we're not going to dictate this.
You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. Two bombs have exploded in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, killing at least 14 people. The authorities say one bomb targeted Shiite pilgrims who were travelling through the city, while the other went off near a police vehicle in a Shiite neighbourhood. The president of the West African state of Guinea-Bissau, Malamba Kai Sanya, has died in a military hospital in Paris after a long illness. He was 64. Last month, an apparent coup attempt in Guinea-Bissau was foiled. Mr. Sanya won the presidential election in 2009 after the country's former leader, João Bernardo Vieira, was assassinated. Since independence from Portugal in 1974, Guinea-Bissau has suffered many military coups and has become one of the main transit points for trafficking cocaine into Europe. An 18-month-old boy has been found dead in a sewage treatment plant after plunging through the pavement in the city of Bryansk in western Russia. The boy's mother was rescued from the large hole that appeared on Sunday. From Moscow, here's Daniel Sanford.
The 26-year-old mother was walking with her baby in a pushchair in the centre of Bryansk when suddenly the ground she was walking on fell away. She managed to grab onto the edge of the 2-metre-wide hole and was pulled to safety by her husband, but their 18-month-old son disappeared into the network of pipes under the city. After a search of over 24 hours, the baby's body was eventually found in the sewage treatment plant.
Three artworks have been stolen from the National Gallery of Greece in Athens, including a painting personally donated by Pablo Picasso to the people of Greece. In a heist that lasted only 7 minutes, burglars forced open a balcony door and made off with four paintings and drawings, but dropped one as a guard gave chase. Yemen has announced the discovery of 200 tombs dating back to the Stone Age. The tombs, complete with embalmed mummies and funerary belongings, were discovered in the mountains in Al-Marwit, northwest of the capital, Sana'a. BBC News.
Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. With so much attention focused on the GOP presidential horse race and the rise of the Tea Party within the Republican Party, there's been very little attention on the Democratic Party and how President Obama's policies fit within the Democratic Party's vision. So on today's Your Call, we are taking a look at the Democratic Party. Last week, we talked about the Republican Party, and this time around, we're talking about the Democrats. Who is the base of the Democratic Party? Who's leading it? And how has it changed over time? The 2012 presidential election is shaping up to be a multi-billion dollar contest. President Obama's reelection committee is expected to raise at least $1 billion. President Obama has been traveling the country attending $38,000 per plate dinners. As of December 1st, 2010, President Obama had 69 fundraisers. That's one every 5 days. For his 2008 presidential election, the President Obama's top donors were from Wall Street. So who's funding the party this time around? And also, who's the base of the party? Who do the Democrats really reach out to? In a recent online column in the New York Times, one of today's guests, Thomas Edzall, writes, "As a practical matter, the Obama campaign and, for the present, the Democratic Party have laid to rest all consideration of reviving the coalition nurtured and cultivated by Franklin D. Roosevelt." Thomas Edzall is a former political reporter for The Washington Post and professor of journalism at Columbia University. He's an online columnist for the New York Times, and his latest book is called The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Remake American Politics, and it comes out tomorrow. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to the show. We are also going to be talking about how the Democratic Party has historically been credited with supporting a woman's right to choose, the establishment of Social Security and Medicare, supporting labor rights and civil liberties. But with the recent signing of the National Authorization Defense Act, actually the National Defense Authorization Act, it's become a policy issue for which President Obama has come under attack by civil liberties groups and human rights groups. The administration is also being scrutinized for caving to the Catholic bishops on the morning after pill. So where do Democrats stand on policies that have historically been considered progressive liberal policies? Loretta Ross is a founder and national coordinator of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective. It's composed of 70 women of color organizations across the country. And Loretta considers herself a lifelong Democrat with many reservations. Hi, Loretta. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on your show.
It's great to have you. And Thomas, are you with us? Oh, we're working on getting Thomas. So Loretta, let's start off with you. It's a big question, but and we'll talk about specifics during the show. As a lifelong Democrat who's really stood up for women's rights, how do you, what are your thoughts on the current state of the Democratic Party?
Well, I think that they are incredibly timid sometimes when it comes up, when it comes to standing up for abortion rights. They can be easily persuaded to jettison abortion rights in tough negotiations, like during the recent health care reform or the Affordable Care Act negotiations, or even the very weak-kneed decision to deny emergency contraception to teenagers under the age of 18, which flew in the face of scientific evidence. that young people can use emergency contraception responsibly. And it seemed to be a caving in to right-wing politics rather than the standing up for women's rights that we really expected out of a pro-choice administration.
You've been doing this work for how long?
Since the 1970s, so more than 35 years.
So what major changes have you seen in the Democratic Party over that time?
Well, of course, the first president I paid any attention to was Lyndon B. Johnson, and he was, of course, a staunch advocate for civil rights, and I've, of course, paid attention to all the presidents, plus I lived in Washington for 20 years. And so sometimes they stand up better for women's rights, and sometimes they cave in. But we really have never had that strong women's rights champion that I long for since the days of the Roosevelt. I'd really like to see more done on behalf of women. I'm really appreciative of the job that Hillary Clinton is doing, Secretary of State, but I would really like to see more out of this administration. For example, helping to pass the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, or the CEDAW bill. The U.S. is the only industrialized country, that has not ratified the Women's Human Rights Treaty. And I'd like to see the administration take leadership on that.
What about labor rights and civil liberties?
Well, I think I'd leave it to my civil liberties expert friends in the ACLU and others to speak to that, but I get the sense from them that they're deeply disappointed in the fact that we haven't gotten rid of Guantanamo yet, that we're talking about indefinite detention of American citizens. I think that there's a lot of things that they could have stood up for and really activated and mobilized their base. And instead, they're disappointing their base. And I'm not afraid that their base is going to turn around and vote for the other side. I'm afraid that their base is going to turn around and just stay at home, that they are, in fact, increasing voter apathy and disappointment.
Well, and since this is a heavily caller-driven show, I'd love to give out the phone number and ask listeners that very question. What do you think the Democrats stand for these days? If you're a Democrat, what does that mean to you? If you've left the party, why? Give us a call, 866-798-8255. Also, what are some of the changes you've seen over the past few decades with the Democratic Party? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And again, the number is 866-798-8255. Loretta Ross is founder of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective. And I understand we're now connected with Thomas Edzall, former political reporter with the Washington Post and online columnist with the New York Times. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to the show.
How are you?
Good, thank you. Great to have you. So you wrote an interesting piece for the New York Times called The Future of the Obama Coalition. We'll talk about that in a minute, but how do you explain, or how would you assess the current state of the Democratic Party?
Well, I think one of the problems that the Democratic Party has is that it's what you might call a bifurcated coalition, that on the one hand it represents poor and lower middle class, working class people. On the other hand, it's got a very strong and very active base of support among liberal, well-educated, fairly affluent voters. Actually, it's trifurcated because it also is financially dependent upon a whole host of sources, including much of Wall Street. These three really don't mix well into a coherent political party. And the result is that the party is not that effective in representing any of those groups. The Republicans tend to win when business has a chance to win with them. Poor people have been getting hit on the head. And liberal social activists they're doing okay. They're actually probably doing the best of the three.
So what does the party stand for these days? I mean, based on the writings you've done, what would you say is at the top of the Democrats' list?
That's a very hard question, frankly. Well, health care had been high on the list, and they won a version of health, universal health care. Financial reform, and that got weakened. But what it stands for coherently, I don't think it doesn't really stand for a coherent position because its constituencies are not coherent. I mean, at once you could have described it as the party of the working men and women, but I don't think you could nowadays. It just doesn't function that way, and it doesn't have the core representation of the working man and woman.
What do you think, Loretta? What does the Democratic Party stand for?
That's a very good question. I think that they try to be compassionate, and I think they try to be pragmatic, and sometimes the two things don't mix. I sometimes wish they were a bit more ruthless towards its opponents, but they are a neoliberal party, and or at least led by neoliberals. And unfortunately, those of us who are more radical or progressive end up voting for them because they're the evil of two lessers.
And Thomas, what would you say about the shift we saw, especially during the Clinton administration? Michael Lind of the New America Foundation wrote an article in Salon talking about the words of Bill Clinton. He's the first one, actually, that said, quote, the era of big government is over. And then there are a number of books about how the Democrats at that time really wanted the money from Wall Street, and therefore they decided to deregulate. Glass-Steagall, for example, was repealed. Can you talk a little bit about the shifts you saw during the Clinton administration?
I'm not sure that it's only the money from Wall Street. I think there was kind of a cultural or intellectual victory that free market, pro-Wall Street deregulation advocates won. And a man named Simon Johnson, who is a former chief economist at the IMF, wrote this up very nicely in The Atlantic, where there was a cultural transformation of Washington, all Washington, including the Democrats. And that hasn't really changed, even with the Obama administration, where the notion that the best possible outcomes come from a free market, that's pretty deeply embedded now. And I'm not sure that Obama himself is willing to address this, even though the distortions in the economy in terms of inequality and sort of who's benefiting from the free market suggest that there are some significant problems with that approach.
Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich says in the early days of the 20th century, the Democratic Party had no trouble embracing economic populism. But by the 60s, the Democratic Party had given up on populism. Gone from presidential campaigns, he says, were tales of greedy businessmen and unscrupulous financiers.
Well, I think with this Occupy Wall Street protest, they're rediscovering their Keynesian roots, so that they're being forced to understand that with the unfettered free market without a social safety net is going to implode as it did. And so I think they're being compelled to revisit that whole concept of a social safety net.
Do you agree with that, Thomas?
To some extent. The safety net has taken a real beating in almost every one of these budget negotiations, the two major ones early on in 2011 and then the debt ceiling debate. Both of those resulted in significant cuts in the social safety net that were acceded to by the Obama administration. Realistically, one problem is that the working class as such, as a percentage of the electorate, is declining. And Democrats may have jumped ship on it a little too fast. But the Democratic Party is struggling with this, and I would say has not developed any kind of coherent response either to the way the country has changed demographically or to the way what globalization has done to the economy.
That is Thomas Edsall, online columnist with the New York Times. His new book, The Age of Austerity, will be out tomorrow. We're also joined by Loretta Ross, founder of Sister Song, Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective. And you can join us. We're talking today about the state of the Democratic Party. What does the party stand for if you're a Democrat or maybe a former Democrat? What's your opinion of the party? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Or if you're not a Democrat, what is your opinion of the party? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Sharon in Redwood City. Hi, Sharon. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I have been a lifelong Democrat, but I really think that we took a wrong direction after the Dukakis campaign when he was called a liberal and he went running and screaming away from that label. And I wish Democrats would get back to, we are liberal, we stand for public education, we stand for making sure that everyone is taken care of. That's not socialist, that's Democrat. And that we actually got some ovaries and stood up to the Republicans and had a statement.
Sharon, what Democrat would fall in line with what you just explained?
I'm sorry, what was that?
What Democrat would fall in line with what you just what you just explained?
Lordy. Kennedy? I can't think of anybody right now who comes right out and embraces the liberal roots of the Democratic Party. I wish I could.
Yeah, and why is that?
Because we're chicken. And I say we because I'm a Democrat, but because, I don't know, we run screaming and running away from the polls and think that's what people want when the Democratic Party needs to stand for something and stand for what we used to stand for, and the people will come back. But as long as we keep going back and forth on what do we think they want, we won't have people sticking with us, and we will have so many people like me who say the Republicans are way too scary, so we'll continue to vote Democrat. But like Loretta said, it's a lesser of two evils.
And do you feel like that's your only option, is to vote for the lesser of two evils?
At this point, I don't want to see any of those Republicans in office. They scare the bejesus out of me. Mm-hmm. But, I don't think of Obama as inherently evil, but he's way too moderate for me.
Well, thanks for calling in, Sharon.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go next to CJ in Oakland. Hi, CJ.
Hi there. I think that the Democrats as well as the Republicans are very scary. Ron Paul's foreign policy I agree with that 100% as a veteran. And I agree with the other guy that they don't give much, the one who worked for Obama as foreign, what was I don't know that guy's name who's running also that doesn't get any airtime, who worked for Obama.
But, John Huntsman?
Yeah, he's not scary either. But Obama is scary to me because Bill Clinton did a lot of damage to the poor and the working class people on his second half. And Obama to me is just as scary. I was a Democrat. I'm no longer a Democrat. I vote for Barbara Lee. I will support her. But neither party represents us. So we need to have a party. We need someone who represents us, but working class and poor don't have representation. I was a social worker also, and we were screaming, about the problems in the 80s and the 90s. And when we go on strike, the union wouldn't support us.
Right.
So the unions are just as corrupt as the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. They don't represent us.
Well, and you bring up a good point, CJ, because when you talk about the working class and the poor, Thomas Edsall, you rarely hear the Democrats talk about the poor.
They don't talk about the poor. Obama hasn't let that word come out of his mouth once.
Right.
That's why I knew when he was running, and I'm African-American, I didn't want to vote for him. I only voted for him because I will never, ever get another chance to vote for a black man. But I don't know what I'll do this time.
And
I do want to hear from Paul on foreign and Huntsman, because I think of the two, they make running together as independents would be the best thing that could happen.
Well, we're going to talk about Ron Paul actually on Thursday, so I hope you can tune in.
Because Ron
in
Paul is very scary to me.
He's scary, but you know,
he's very scary to me.
Well, thank you, CJ. Feel free to call in on that when we talk about that. Loretta, CJ makes a great point about the poor and the working class. You hardly hear the Democrats talk about the poor.
Well, I never had any illusions when I voted for President Obama in the past that he was going to be a progressive or radical politician. I really felt that I was choosing between a neoliberal and a neo-fascist. And I think that that's what we've got. So I don't think he ever misled us. I think that we packed in him all our hopes and dreams, and we packed in more than he could deliver. And maybe that sounds a bit cynical of me, but I really do believe that he is governing the way he promised to govern, but despite his overblown campaign promises. But
and where does that leave you, though, Loretta? I mean, if you don't have many choices, where does that leave someone like you, who's you've dedicated your life to securing basic human rights and reproductive rights for women?
But I've lived in America all my life, and America is an old country that has yet to offer us a proper human rights candidates for president. Mm. So this is not a new scenario.
Mm-hmm. So it's this is what you got, basically.
Yeah, you dance with the boy that brought you to the dance. I mean, this is what you do. In a system where you do your work outside the electoral system to empower grassroots people and poor people, while at the same time you participate in the electoral system, it's an end. It's not an either or. And I am concerned about not only apathy, but how we who are progressive and left can be so easily seduced by a dangerous person like Ron Paul, just because he's an alleged libertarian, but he's not libertarian, for example, with wanting to outlaw all abortions. You know, he's strictly fascist when it comes to that. Oh, fascistic.
He did sign the personhood pledge.
Right.
So, well, on that, and we'll talk more about this on Thursday, I think it's because you don't even hear Democrats talking like Ron Paul on foreign policy.
Yeah, exactly.
Thomas, what would you add to that, specifically on CJ's call?
I think the other thing that's missing here is that the Democratic Party has been wary of speaking about poor people because poor people have increasingly become identified as black and minority. And they are scared, basically, that they're going to divide their electorate along racial lines, and in that equation, they'll lose the election. The party has, if it's going to represent working people, it does have a huge vacuum in that it has lost the support of the white working class, particularly whites without college degrees. If it's going to be a coherent coalition representing the Joe Sixpack or Jill and Joe Sixpack, it has to be a biracial coalition, and at that level, and at this point, it is not a biracial coalition. It has lost too much. It gets like 35% to 40% of the white working class vote and loses the majority of it to the Republican Party. That is, in terms of an economically coherent coalition, that is a big gaping hole in the Democratic Party.
But, Mr. Edsel, how can they do that, appeal to that white working class constituent, without tilting to the right?
They can make it clear that the policies that they are pushing are for the benefit of all working people, and they're not only focused on programs that benefit different identity groups. They have to do something to broaden their appeal to that constituency. Those people are not all racists. Some of them are just people who feel that the Democratic Party is not pushing goals on jobs, on other unemployment benefits, on economic growth that benefit them. And they have a those voters were crucial to the New Deal coalition, which was more of a economically coherent coalition. But right now you have a, in addition to these class differences within the Democratic Party, there are racial splits that are really wounding to the party.
And hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Today we're talking about the current state of the Democratic Party. We'd love to hear from you. We've got full lines. We'll have a line open just after we come back. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
KALW San Francisco, online, kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about the show and leave a comment at our fairly new website, yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, how are you dealing with health care if you're uninsured or underinsured? We'll talk about the new coverage options available in the Affordable Care Act and what resources are really available for those of us who don't have health care or don't have much coverage. So if you've got any questions, tomorrow would be a good time to call in. Wednesday, we'll be talking about the marijuana industry and the federal crackdown. And then Thursday, we'll talk about liberal and progressive support for Ron Paul. What's your opinion of Ron Paul and the Libertarian platform? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're talking about the current state of the Democratic Party. What are your thoughts on the Democrats? What do they stand for? If you're a Democrat or a former Democrat, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thomas Edsall is an online columnist with the New York Times. His latest book, The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Remake American Politics, will be out tomorrow. Loretta Ross is founder of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective. And we've got full lines, so let's go through a few callers and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Jamie in Santa Cruz. Hi, Jamie.
Hi. I'll try to be brief, but there are three themes that I really want to bring up. One is that it's famous that Democrats love to argue with each other, and the progressives, as we just heard at least several callers, like to be mad at the rest of them. And, you know, when I was in Eugene McCarthy's campaign way back against LBJ after he turned for the war, the major fundraiser said the biggest problem was our arguing with each other. The second thing that's important is that we don't have discipline. If it's actually true that the largest constituency that can break through the racial differences that, in fact, it was just spoken about, is the identification with middle-class values among the working poor, and that is the next step up from Medi-Cal and the middle class, then, in fact, it's quite possible that the party could choose to be the party of the middle class and the would-be middle class. And I believe that that is really the answer to the party's problem. The problem is that they won't, the one thing they don't learn from the Republicans is that they won't stay on any kind of message. And the reason that that fails is that there's so many messages that none of us can discern, as your guests cannot, what the party believes in. It isn't some kind of fascistic, stupid unanimity that I'm requesting. It's simply enough discipline among the party leaders so that they do, in fact, articulate what the party is about. And it is correct that I'm a little upset about that, but I don't expect, as a progressive, which I also am, to be in the center of the party. The party has to be in the center of the United States. So therefore, as a progressive, I'm going to be outside of that center. But that's okay. I'm on the left side of the Democratic Party. That's fine. What we need to do is to look at just that kind of data that your male speaker is speaking about, understand how many people identify themselves with the middle class. And I think Obama's right about that. What he's really talking about is that this is the party of the middle class, not the upper class. And let the Republicans identify with the upper class and allow a difference to emerge from the realists, who would be the Democrats, who are dealing with the world as it is, and the unrealists, who simply want to support the corporations and the small number of 1%. That's the openness that is permitted by the left protests, is to wake up to see that identification of the party could in fact work. Thank you very much.
All right, we'll get a comment in just a minute. Thank you for calling, Jamie. Let's go next to Brian in San Francisco. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm also a Democrat and a progressive. I am very excited about the Rebuild the American Dream movement and the fact that they've issued a 10-point contract for America, which is a coherent platform, and the Democratic Party, the Progressive Caucus, has issued legislation advocating for this, which is basically focused on, you know, jobs and green energy and defending the poor. I'm interested in what your guests have to say about the Rebuild the American Dream movement. It's a center-left, you know, alliance of groups that have millions of members, like the AFL-CIO and the Sierra Club, and they say that they're going to be running 1,000 candidates, what they call 99% candidates, in 2012, from everything from the Board of Education to Congress. And I think in Marin County, the candidate who might be closely identified as a 99% candidate is Norman Solomon. So there are actually candidates out there that represent this position within the Democratic Party, called the Contract for the American Dream.
All right. Thank you, Brian. We'll take a few more calls, and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Richard in Oakland. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
The gentleman who just spoke about the middle, I think, sort of echoes my point a little bit. And I think not only talking about the economic middle, but the political middle and the spiritual middle. I think the key word for the Democrats, and it's been mentioned, but it hasn't been dwelled on, is pragmatism. The voting public has generally moved to the right. The middle class is more right than the lower class, and the upper class is just far right. And I think that radical policies won't get a candidate elected, let alone reelected. And I think Obama, look at what happened to the whole universal health care thing. It's been watered down so much because it's moving more toward the middle than radical. President Obama revealed his hand when he picked Joe Biden to be his president. I mean, his vice president. It wasn't a choice of idealism. It was a choice of pragmatism, and that's where he's going. And I think he's playing to what that caller who said play to the middle. That's where Obama is.
Well, all right. So thank you for calling in. Thomas, we've got a lot of opinions here. There's a lot to unpack. Why don't you respond, and then we can talk more about, you know, what this sort of center-right, what this means. Because, for example, if you're talking about taxes, poll after poll after poll shows the majority of the public believes that the wealthy should pay higher taxes to deal with social services and to deal with the deficit and to improve income inequality. That's just a fact, right? But you have Obama extending the Bush tax cut, and then people like John Kerry saying they want to bring down the high rate from, or the rate from 30% to 28%.
First, let me just say, I thought the first caller was pretty savvy in his point of view. But let's look at this. The Republican Party has been doing a number of things, particularly the clearest evidence is the one you just cited, where it seems to be they're going directly against public opinion, but they don't seem to pay that much of a price for it.
Right.
So you have to ask, what's going on beyond the public polling? And again, I think there are problems of race involved here, where people say they are willing to pay more taxes, but another thing that people don't say publicly or into it to a pollster is, I'm bothered because I'm worried that too much of the government spending that my tax dollars go to pay for go to what they see as the undeserving poor and what they also see as a disproportionately minority poor. That is a issue that has to be dealt with by the Democratic Party, and it has to be dealt with in a way that voters are going to be convinced that the benefits of their programs are going well beyond minorities, that they're going basically to everybody who qualifies. That is going to take some work on the Democratic Party's part because, for example, when Obama pushed the health care program, it cost $1 trillion, and half of the cost of that $1 trillion over 10 years came from $500 billion in cuts in Medicare, primarily from the Medicare Advantage program, which has been heavily criticized. But old people heard that, and they said, Medicare, which we see as our program, these are old people thinking, is getting cut by $500 billion in order to expand health care for them, by which they see as poor and minority people getting health care that they hadn't had before. That these zero-sum views on programs have to be addressed, or they're going to cause the kind of problem for the Democratic Party that it had in 2010 when old people defected by the millions from the party, and you ended up with the election of a Republican House and a lot of lost Democratic seats in the Senate. So, at any rate, that's my two cents for the moment.
And Loretta, do you have anything to add on the calls?
Well, I echo everything he said, because as long as the Democratic Party flinches every time race or immigration is mentioned, they're not going to be very persuasive. And they're not addressing the fact that it is very much a driving force within the Tea Party movement, within the anti-Obama movement, and it is speaking a certain tone deafness towards his base. I think the Democratic Party could do worse than identifying itself with the 99% movement, because that's an unambiguous movement that says, we know who we're standing up for, do you?
Well, thank you for the calls, and we're going to talk now about where the Democratic Party is getting its money, and I'd like to welcome Peter Stone to the show. Peter leads the money and politics team at the Center for Public Integrity. He is author of Casino Jack and the United States of Money. Hi, Peter. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, good to be with you.
Good to have you, and thanks for holding on the line there. So I'm taking a look at opensecrets.org. The Democrats have raised almost $256 million so far. The Republicans have raised $227 million so far. President Obama has been traveling around the country. It doesn't really get that much attention, but he's going to about one fundraiser every 5 days, and it costs $38,000 at many of these fundraisers to have dinner. So when you look at the money, where is the majority of this money coming from?
Well, the majority is coming from a pretty good mix of high roller, big deep-pocketed donors who can afford the max, and that money gets split between the campaign, which can only accept $2,500 per election, and the party committee, which can accept the balance of it. You know, a lot of it is coming from those kind of donors. I haven't seen an exact breakdown yet this year, but the Democrats have also maintained a good bit of their small donor base from 2008, which did spectacularly well and which was one of the hallmarks of the Obama campaign during 2008. I think there's a lot of concern that because of the ongoing recession, the disillusionment of part of the base with Obama's performance, and other factors that the small donor base may not be quite as aggressive and quite as successful this time around as it was in 2008. And I think many of the larger donors and fundraisers who are called bundlers are probably going to have to pick up a little more of the slack, which means that overall the party committee and the campaign will be more reliant on folks who can afford larger contributions, basically.
The Daily Beast reports that close to 100 of the big money bundlers for Obama's reelection team have ties to investment banks such as Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America. Last time around, the Obama team raised more money from Wall Street than the McCain team. Do you expect, or are you seeing the same trend this time around?
No, he's definitely lost support on Wall Street. It's clear that he does not have the same kind of support that he did in 2008. A good bit of that drop-off stems from the anger at the Dodd-Frank financial services reforms that the Obama administration backed and that passed Congress. He's still going to have a healthy amount of support, and I think those figures you cited are probably on target. I've seen other figures, but you know, he's got a base there that's still with him. But I think the legislation alienated a lot of people on Wall Street. They've spent a lot of time over the last year trying to roll back the legislation as regulations are being written. They still haven't finished writing much of the regulations to implement the legislation. Wall Street is, and others in the financial services community, are very upset about one of the centerpieces of the reform, and that was the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was the brainchild of Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren, who's now running for Senate, as we know, in Massachusetts. That was one of the key things that Wall Street and many financial service companies were upset about. But they're also trying to keep the budgets in check and, in fact, push back on budgets for agencies, regulatory agencies like the SEC. There are other parts, too, which are, you know, of great concern to many executives on Wall Street. So his support there is definitely declining. I still think he has large, obviously, he still has large support in the union community. But there, too, I defer to Thomas Edsel and his work on this as to whether or not it'll be as strong as it was in 2008. But I think that, you know, the campaign is shooting to do probably as well as they did, which was a record-setting 740-some-odd million in 2008. Whether they get there again, I think, is going to be a tough road to climb. Some people think they may even do better. Mm. There have been some projections that they could raise $1 billion this time around.
Wow.
I think that's a little bit fanciful, but we'll see.
Do you expect the 2012 election will be, what, between $1 and $3 billion this time?
No, it'll be a lot more than that.
Wow.
I mean, it'll be closer to $6, maybe $7 billion.
$7 billion.
The last congressional election in 2010 was roughly $4 billion.
Right.
This year we have the presidential and the congressional elections, and we have the growth of outside groups, the burgeoning of outside groups, particularly on the Republican side, but now on the Democratic side too, which are raising hundreds of millions of dollars in unlimited contributions because of the Supreme Court's ruling last year in the, in 2010, in the Citizens United case, which gave the green light for the first time for corporations, unions, and individuals to write unlimited checks to pay for ads and other electoral tools that will expressly advocate for the defeat or the election of presidential candidates, members of Congress, and others. Mm. So these outside groups, which started to appear in the 2010 election, particularly on the Republican side with the Karl Rove-created Crossroads, are now being mimicked on the Democratic side. And the Democrats are playing catch-up, not very successfully so far, but the Republicans are forging ahead in record amounts, We also have the presidential super PACs this year, which are another phenomenon that springs out of the court decisions, where the PACs affiliated with candidates for president, specific candidates for president, are starting to raise, have raised millions of dollars from individuals primarily. Romney's campaign led the way last year in this with $12 million of contributions in the first 6 months. Just this weekend, we learned that a casino mogul, Sheldon Adelson, one of the richest men in America, whose fortune is over $20 billion, will be giving $5 million at least to a PAC affiliated with former Speaker Gingrich. They've long been close, and they share very similar views on Adelson's top issue, which is taking an extremely hard line on U.S. support for Israel.
Well, God, you're busy, to say the least, and thank you for all those facts. We will definitely follow this throughout the year as so much money is being distributed in this campaign, and we'd love to have you back in a couple of months. Thank you for joining us, Peter.
Sure. I appreciate it.
That is Peter Stone. He leads the Money and Politics team at the Center for Public Integrity. He's author of Casino Jack and the United States of Money. And we've got just about 7 minutes left, so we have time to take a few more calls, and then we'll get responses from Thomas Edzall and Loretta Ross. We have one line open, and the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Today we're talking about the current state of the Democratic Party. And again, Peter says this next election is going to cost about $7 billion. It's hard to believe. Let's hear from Richard in San Francisco. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, hello, Rose. My friends in England, I've lived in America for more than half of my life. My friends in England and the rest of Europe ask me about politics in America when I'm home, and I tell them this. There are two parties in the United States. That's about all you've got. There's a right-wing party that's pretty nationalistic. They're Bible thumpers. I don't know one of them who's come out and said they're an atheist despite their education level. And they're capitalists. That's the Democrats. Now, the Republicans are even to the right of the Democrats. There's really no choice here. The Democratic Party is to the right wing of my Conservative Party in England. Margaret Thatcher, at the height of her powers, could not get the capital punishment reinstated in England. At the height of her powers, she tried to destroy the National Health Service. Her own party would not support it. We have no choice here anymore. That's why there's no passion.
Well, thank you for calling in, Richard. I was just overseas and heard the same thing from people all over Europe, that your Democratic Party is to the right of our Conservative Party. Maybe not on immigration, but on so many other issues. So thank you for calling. Let's hear from Arturo in San Francisco. Hi, Arturo. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rosa. Thanks for taking the call. I'd just like to kind of reinforce what Loretta said earlier, that what you have here in the U.S. is USA is a neo-fascist party, a neoliberal party, and it functionally it comes down to a neo-fascist party and a collaborationist party. And I think that, and with all the implications that that word carries from the 1940s, and I think concentrating on the National Party is probably a mistake. You need to look no further than Sacramento and the performance art engaged in by the Democrats in trading away the poorest, like funding for the poorest of the poor, and for students, for immigrants, and whatnot, in exchange for concessions from Schwarzenegger, who made his fortune peddling nostrums to gay people, to gay men, mainly for his weightlifting nostrums, and certain interests in the Democratic Party found no problems in accommodating this.
What is nostrum?
Nostrum. It's like a magic potion that will make you strong. In other words, steroids are used normally by weightlifters, but he was peddling stuff to that were not even potent. One other thing I'd like to add very quickly is that one thing that's been overlooked here is the initiation of a new Cold War with China and the establishment of new bases in Australia, and what the implications of what this will be for the future.
Well, thank you for calling in. We're going to be talking about that on our Friday Media Roundtable. We got a number of emails. One listener says, Let me find this email. I'd like your guest to tell me something that McCain, let alone Bush, would have done in economic or foreign policy that Obama, the neoliberal and warmonger continuing to provoke Iran and now provoking China, would not have done or did not continue to do. We also have an email saying the Democratic Party is extremely ruthless, not with Republicans, but with anyone who challenges the two-party representative fiction. Thomas, again, we have so many calls that we can't get to and so many emails. People are clearly very extremely frustrated with the current state of the Democratic Party.
They should be. Although, in fairness to Obama, he has pulled out of Iraq, which I'm not sure what Bush would have done by now. And he is making some moves to pull out of Afghanistan. So on that score, I'm not sure you can just equate him with the prior administration. But the Democratic Party has very serious hurdles in terms of going beyond winning when people are just opposed to the Republican Party, which they were in 2008 and 2006. And right now they're really banking on the idea that Mitt Romney and the congressional Republicans will be not attractive to enough voters that they will then turn to the Democratic Party. It's not as if the Democratic Party is winning. It's more that they are not losing. When they win, it's because they're not losing, not because they are actually winning. And the creation of a real majority is still eludes them in terms of, whereas the Republican Party for 40 years until really 2008 had a kind of functional working coalition that it could depend upon. The Democratic Party has a ways to go on this front.
And Loretta Ross, your final thoughts?
Well, I think the election of 2012 from the Democratic Party, they have to give us an option of what we're standing for, not just what we're standing against. Until they define that moral stance that they're compelling and calling on us to take, they're not going to re-energize us. They're not going to get us excited. And I'm afraid that they're going to squander all the hope, particularly of young people, that they were able to arouse in 2008.
Loretta Ross is founder and national coordinator of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective, and Thomas Edzall is an online columnist with the New York Times. His latest book comes out tomorrow. It's called The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Remake American Politics. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for your phone calls and emails. Sorry we didn't get to all of you. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. Are you uninsured or underinsured? If so, how are you dealing with health care? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the Affordable Care Act. What are the new coverage options? Here in California, the cost of health insurance is rising more rapidly than family incomes. So what resources are available for those of us who don't have health care or don't have much coverage? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What's in store for the future of health care? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar. And you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.